Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As the news unfolded over the weekend of the devastation in Paris, the impact of terrorist attacks on the victims, their families, the city, and the entire nation, here in New Hampshire, French flags flew, and the state's leaders expressed their support. Now the big question is, what's next for the NATO alliance and the United States, given the attacks on America's oldest ally, France? French airstrikes have already begun on Islamic State targets in Syria, and many in this country are calling for tougher military action against the terrorist group. Also, the attacks have once again raised concerns, both here and in Europe, about how widely to open the door to refugees from the Syrian conflict. Today in The Exchange, reaction and response in this country to what happened in Paris. Let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, thoughts, concerns. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have guests, three guests for the hour. Sarwar Kashmiri joins us, fellow of the Foreign Policy Association, adjunct professor at Norwich University. Sarwar speaks often before business and military audiences. His last book was NATO 2.0. Sarwar, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. With me in studio, James Ramsey, professor of security studies at UNH. And James Ramsey, nice to meet you. Thank you also for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
And joining us also by phone, Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College, contributor to the forthcoming book, The New Islamic State. And Wayne, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
Well, Wayne, I want to start with you because, as I understand, your in-laws were in Paris over the weekend. Tell us what you heard from them.
They were. So about 9 o'clock Paris time, we got a text from my mother-in-law with a picture of the Eiffel Tower at night. And we're very excited because this is one of their bucket list things. And they had just arrived that morning, and so they were enjoying it. And about an hour later, we started hearing the news about the attacks in Paris. So, of course, what I study and teach about became very real for me in a very different way and for my wife. And about 2 o'clock that morning, we finally got word from them that they were safe and okay in their hotel, and that, you know, that was about it. And so it was quite a harrowing night, a very personal, you know, matter, and scary matter for us, with them just arriving in Paris. And as of now, they're staying and they're going to finish their vacation and make the most of it.
Well, really, we hear so many sites are closed. I wonder what they're going to do, Wayne.
They are walkers. They have been walking the city and seeing it, and they've seen a lot of the sort of peaceful gatherings. And eventually, they're going to be leaving Paris and seeing other parts of France. But they are, you know, for now, they felt like they wanted to be there. They wanted to be part of what they were seeing and this is, I guess, their new revised experience.
Wow. Well, taking off your son-in-law hat, Wayne, and putting on your professorial hat again, especially with the forthcoming book, The New Islamic State. Lots of commentary over the weekend, Wayne. Many observers saying the West needs to recalculate its strategy toward ISIS. How would you describe that strategy now, Wayne, and how much do you think it will change?
Well, the president announced, you know, in the aftermath of some really spectacular successes by ISIS in Iraq in particular, that the United States was going to employ a strategy of degrading and destroying ISIS, that it was going to largely feature an air campaign. So what we've heard in the news is that the U.S. military is launching airstrikes against ISIS positions, and we've been doing this for about a year and a half now, regularly. It hasn't had the impact, I think, that we would like to see, and it really hasn't destroyed ISIS for sure, And certainly, while ISIS does not command as much territory as it once did in places like Iraq, I would not describe ISIS as having been significantly degraded. That strategy has changed. As early as this past Friday, the president said, forget degrade and destroy. Really, we're focusing on containing ISIS, and went on to say something to the effect that ISIS, did not pose a significant threat to us here in the United States. And so that's juxtaposed up against what happened Friday night in Paris, has a lot of folks questioning whether or not we're employing the right strategy. And as you alluded to in your open, the reality is not just about what's happening in Iraq and Syria, not just what's happening in Paris, but the fact that we are going to be and are admitting refugees from that region to the United States. And that's raised a lot of concerns. A lot of governors now, or some governors now, have indicated they're rethinking whether or not they want to admit those refugees to their states. And at the very least, serious questions are being asked about how we're screening those individuals coming in. The concern being that could there be ISIS supporters among them who are using this as a refugee status as a way to get into the United States to engage in terrorist activities here.
All right.
So that's sort of the big picture of where we are now.
Sure. And so much to untangle this hour. And Sarwar, I want to bring you into this too. Wayne alluded to this, so I'd love for you to follow up. What do these attacks say about our understanding of ISIS and its broader goals? You know, seemed not that long ago, Sarwar, that we thought that their goal more was to establish, an Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. I mean, that's their name, right? Islamic State, Iraq, Syria. Now it seems like they have broader goals.
Well, that's a really important question. And by the way, I just want to take a few seconds and say how sorry I am. I know we all are for what the French are going through. But on the ISIS situation, I look at what happened in Paris slightly differently from some analysts. In other words, ISIS is not doing this because they don't like liberties and they don't like freedoms and so on. They're doing it because they're at a war with the West. They've declared a war with the West a long time back, and when you're in a position where there is an overwhelming militarily strong foe opposing you, the only way you can fight is by doing asymmetric attacks, is by doing things that the other side does not expect. And that, what I believe, is taking place and has taken place in Paris. So this is ISIS now unleashing their way of fighting war. And I think we need to keep that in mind. And we need to respond militarily, but we also need to respond in many other ways.
Many other ways, such as, Sarwar?
Well, if you take the Muslim population of the world, there are about a little over a billion Muslims. Roughly half a billion of them are under 30. These people use social media, iPhones, very much like people in Europe and America do. And I would submit, as important as the military reaction is, we've just not engaged enough in trying to sway hearts and minds and fight a social media war, an internet war, things that ISIS has perfected. As you know, they've got very slick media relations, they've got very slick recruitment videos, and so that's another area that we really need to focus on. And finally, I might just say that there's a big difference between refugees and people who can sneak into Europe than in America. The U.S. has spent about $60 billion a year since 9/11 in improving homeland security.
$60
billion? 60, yeah.
Okay.
It's over that, actually. And so the idea that people can sneak in as easily as they can in Europe while it is there is enormously different. I think we are much more secure, cannot drop our sites, but I just wanted to point that out.
Well, and so much to follow up on, Sarwar. The hearts and minds issue, for example, we talked about that with Republican presidential candidate John Kasich last week. And because of the attacks, by the way, we will not be airing that interview with Governor Kasich. But you can listen to it on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, or our podcast. So we'll definitely talk more about that hearts and minds issue, because it is important. But I also want to follow up with you, James Ramsey. Sarwar said this is an act of war. The president of France called this an act of war. Pope Francis called it a piece of the piecemeal Third World War, his words. Is this war, James Ramsey?
Thanks, Laura. And I would totally concur with those observations. It is an act of war. I mean, ISIS wages an asymmetric transnational insurgents group. They don't look like a normal symmetric military foe that we've had during the Cold War. They act differently. They act within their sphere of influence, and they act within their sphere of skill sets. So they don't acknowledge borders the way we do. They don't really acknowledge flags and nation states the way we do. And from their perspective, they're doing everything they can to motivate the development of the caliphate that they think is their God-given obligation. So they've made this a religious war for the most part. But as Sarwar mentioned, they're extremely vertically integrated as well. Everything from robust preschool training all the way through weapons training and bomb manufacturing to how you construct cities and how you construct an educational system.
Preschool training.
Oh, yeah. There's some evidence to indicate that they are very interested in training kids from ground up, as it were, to think in terms of the way their ideology wants them to think regarding the West and regarding the development of their military insurgents. So they're using primarily military means and horror. I mean, it's the root of terrorism, right, to strike terror. It is a fear-based campaign because the brutality that they wage basically leads them to create change, social change, whatever, you know, economic, political, social change their objective might be, through fear. I mean, on the one hand, they say, don't attack us because we'll attack you. And on the other hand, they go ahead and instigate some horrific actions as they have in Paris and in Beirut and even in Egypt just a few days ago with the Russian plane.
Yeah, a lot of people have been talking about these three attacks. Absolutely. in quick succession. It mm-hmm. seems like, you know, I'd like to get your thoughts too, James, on the question I asked Wayne and Sarwar. What do these attacks say about ISIS and its broader goals? Again, you know, a year ago, we kind of thought that they wanted to just establish their own foothold in the Middle East. Now it seems like they have much broader goals.
Right. I mean, and I'm not a religious studies scholar, but the idea of a caliphate, I think, is really sort of a limited perspective of what they actually have in mind at this point. I think they have an expressed desire to become the most violent terrorist organization on the planet. I mean, taking that mantle from Al-Qaeda and possibly others. They absolutely have an expansionistic perspective, whether it's to spread fundamentalist Islam or it's just to simply take a religious basis to how they structure society and spread that around the world. They have a goal of expanding their sphere of influence throughout the entire Middle East, North Africa, and most of Europe, including Spain, within the next few years. So expansionism is definitely, I think, something we read into this. And that means that our response domestically in the U.S., both by ourselves as well as with our allies, really is something that needs to be recalculated at this point.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we are getting reaction here in New Hampshire to the attacks in Paris, whether these are a game changer in terms of our response approach toward ISIS. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Wayne L'Esperance, what about this idea of, you know, is this war? Is it a traditional war? How do we respond if we do call this a war, as the president of France did?
It is a war. I mean, I think that the other guests are exactly right. I mean, they've declared war on us, and we have tried to manage it from afar. And I think what Paris teaches us is that what is over there is increasingly becoming over here. You know, a lot of analysts have focused on the fact that this is something new, that, you know, ISIS was very much, you know, when we discovered them, when we found them to be a threat last summer, or a year ago last summer, you know, it was because they were making a march on Baghdad. They had taken Mosul, a major city, the second largest city in Iraq. They, with 800 fighters, had defeated 30,000 Iraqi soldiers who basically ran away. That was scary, but it was over there. And so the response was to this force that may be frightening to us, but was far away and isolated. Paris is not so far away. And the idea that somehow that could not get to the United States, however difficult, well, 9/11 has taught us that that's certainly not something outside the realm of possibility. So it is war. It is a different kind of war. And what's required is different. The other thing is that because of the conflicts that we've been involved with for so long in terms of the war on terror, The American people, you know, they're skeptical, and I think that it's fair to say that there's not a desire to rush into the kind of war that we saw when we went into Iraq and Afghanistan, and the president has echoed that sentiment. But the fact remains that this is a threat. This is a very real threat, and the United States has a role to play. What that looks like, I guess we'll have to wait to see. But certainly the government in France has taken the decision that this is war, and they are fighting. And our allies in the region, the Jordanians, the Kurds, and others have been in this fight for a while and have been asking for our help. So we can talk about what the United States can do, and we probably should talk about that. But at this point, we've got to do something more than what we're doing now.
Something more than what we're doing now, meaning the airstrikes, Wayne.
Yes, the airstrikes, the limited training of troops, the very small footprint of American troops there in the region, and what other options do we have? And I think we have to think of all of them. By the way, I'm not suggesting that the only answer is that we launch a major ground offensive or ground war. There are lots of other things that we should and could be doing, and not the least of which is supporting our allies when they're asking for support to fight ISIS. The Kurds, for example, are doing some pretty good things. The extent that we are supporting them is we are, but we should be doing more for them and helping them in their strikes against ISIS.
Well, one commentary on CNN, Sarwar said, airstrikes are not enough. It's not serious, and ISIS knows it. This is this commentator again. This person said the only fighting forces on the ground against ISIS are the Kurdish Peshmerga. Certainly tough, but outnumbered and so forth. What do you think, Sarwar?
Well, I think, first of all, that President Obama is on exactly the right track. This is an important issue for the United States, but this is basically, if I may say so, not our fight. If you take the countries around the area of ISIS, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Jordan, United Arab Emirates, these countries, I should point out, have over a million people under arms. They have hundreds of jet fighters. They have thousands of armored vehicles. I simply don't understand why they cannot defeat 30,000 or whatever ISIS people there are. That leads me to believe that they don't want to put their skin in the game. Some of them, like Saudi Arabia, are actually financing some of these extremist ideologies in Islam, and I think we will have to reconsider the kind of alliances we have. So I am very much against the United States taking the lead in this. I agree with what Secretary Albright said many years ago, that the United States is an indispensable, the indispensable nation, but not alone. I would not like to see the United States go in there, take the leadership role. I think we should provide support, but other people in the region need to be taking the lead. That's my feeling.
Well, it's interesting, and what you're saying, Sarwar, echoes what some presidential candidates say, not all. Of course, there are a lot of candidates this year, so there's a wide array of opinions. What do you think about that statement, James Ramsey? Go ahead, Wayne.
Sorry, this is Sarwar.
Go ahead. Yeah.
If I might just finish by saying that the United States, over the last 15 years, has made a lot of enemies in the Middle East. We do not hold the kind of credibility that we used to have a long time ago. And if we start to throw our weight around militarily, we'll get into more trouble in that respect. And as Afghanistan has shown, after 15 years of fighting, the mightiest country in the world has not been able to prevail. So we need to be very careful here, and I'm totally behind the strategy that the president is using.
You know, I'd love your thoughts, too, on that, James Ramsey. I've heard some presidential candidates, not all, say this is not our fight. Let them figure it out in the Middle East. But then other people are saying, look, they did this in Paris. They're probably planning something in New York or D.C. or Boston or who knows. So.
Well, that's certainly a great question. I think Sarwar's point is well taken, as is Wayne's. You know, it's complex, and complexity breeds confusion politically because the political imperative is to be as simply stated as possible, not only for the consuming public during an election year, but also in creating policy. The problem with complexity is it breeds networks, and networks breed wicked problems. And, you know, this is clearly a wicked problem. It's a difficult thing to think about. We have allies. We have allies that really require our support. And at the beginning, Sarwar's right. We are not there. We need to be supportive. But at some point, the war may actually come to our shores. We need to respond differently. The problem with asymmetries in general is that they are not evenly distributed.
All right. We'll talk more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, U.S. and New Hampshire reaction to the Paris attacks over the weekend. By the way, because of the attacks, we will not be airing our interview with John Kasich last Thursday. You can hear it on our website, though, nhpr.org/exchange, or our podcast. You can call in now with your thoughts, feelings, questions, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, James Ramsey, professor of security studies at UNH. On the phone, Wayne L'Esperance, professor of political science at New England College, contributor to the forthcoming book, The New Islamic State. And also by phone, Sarwar Kashmiri, fellow of the Foreign Policy Association, adjunct professor at Norwich University. His last book was NATO 2.0. All of you, let's go to our listeners now and hear what they're thinking about. And first up is Steve in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. I have a number of concerns. All I've heard is Paris, 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 which is horrible and should be focused on. However, I've been led to believe that there were simultaneous attacks in Iraq, Beirut, and Kenya. If this is true, why are we only talking about Paris? And, by the way, last week, an Israeli father and son were killed in Hebron. So there's a lot of violence in the world, but we're almost European-centric in our view of the world.
Well, Steve, thank you. And I want to let you know that David sent a Facebook comment earlier saying, I have a question. An equally horrific bombing took place in Lebanon 2 days before the Paris bombing, but the level of coverage is remarkably different in terms of intensity. David says, is it a case of death being news only when it's white people dying? The stark contrast in coverage displays media bias quite well. So, Sarwar, I'll throw this to you. Steve and David both saying, hey, you know, there have been other terrible attacks and we don't focus on them as much as we do this one. What do you think, Sarwar?
I've been getting a lot of tweets and other social media across my desk to the same effect. And I think there is a great deal of truth to that, that we simply do not pay enough attention to killings in non-Western cities. And I think it's a pity. But having said that, it's the latest occurrence that takes the limelight. And Paris, being the kind of city that it is, does that. But I think we need to look very deeply at how we react to these events. And I think that Steve has a very good point, and we ought to think about changing how all of us, not just the media, react to these tragedies.
Well, Steve, thank you for the call. David, thank you for the Facebook comment. Here's an email from Kevin who says they run their war on funding from obvious sources. We need to shut them and their supporting funding countries by freezing assets and tying up their financial resources. We cannot defeat a concept with bombs. I'd like to hear your guests' thoughts on this approach. Kevin, thank you very much. And James, I'll turn to you on that. There is a lot of talk about why don't we just try harder to shut down the financial networks that fund these organizations.
Well, that's certainly a valid point. And I think that that's one of the things that we've been actually attempting to do for quite some time. The funding streams are complex and interdigitated across, you know, nefarious and legitimate companies. They're also tied to oil, and the West's, you know, got a very strong addiction to oil, basically running our day-to-day life size. So,
although we're supposedly oil energy independent now, right, with all the,
well,
the fracking and so forth?
Yeah, well, I don't think we're necessarily particularly independent. We
all
have
right.
a growing population that has a growing thirst for it. And also, I would say that the less developed world is growing more quickly than the developed world, and they have a growing thirst for energy that's basically fossil fuel-based. And so we have an ongoing challenge on the planet to kind of fuel the activities of daily living as we've defined our social infrastructures with something like a fossil fuel. But I wanted to key in on the concept of you can't beat a concept with bombs. There are many tools or instruments in national power that are available to a sitting president. And one of the things that I find interesting is that we have the world's most potent military, I would wager, and I think I could say with some clarity that we do. But it's only one tool. The military is one tool of intimate international power. We have other things available to us. And I think that one of the things that we need to consider is broadening the scope of our responses to include human security-oriented issues, environmental security-oriented issues. We have to make ISIS less relevant as an organization to the recruiting base. And when we do that, we will be able to, I think, actually degrade and erode them in a more quick pace.
Does that mean the hearts and minds argument that Sarwar talked about earlier?
Well, absolutely. I think hearts and minds is a phrase that goes back, at least in my life,
to
Vietnam.
Yeah.
It's a little bit cliche. But I think it also means more than just a military solution. You know, there's a role for the military solution in groups like ISIS. But what we found out with al-Qaeda and what we know with al-Shabaab and Boko Haram and other insurgent groups that are transnational in their force projection is that a military solution alone is not sufficient. So we have an insufficient solution that's probably required at a variety of times during our engagement with these groups, but we have to have a more comprehensive solution.
Insufficient because no matter how many attacks you thwart, there's always five more.
I think it's a Hydra example from Greek mythology. Yeah, we cut off, you know, we assassinated bin Laden and they simply went in another direction. So I think from that perspective, we need State Department solutions, we need development solutions, we need economic solutions, we need everything to be brought to bear, as well as the ability to halt them militarily.
Yeah, it's hard to go in and do economic development while there's a war going on. But yeah, someone wants to jump in. Is that you, Wayne?
It's Wayne, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really important point. The long-term strategy has to be to address the underlying conditions that lead people to conclude that ISIS is the best bet for them in their lives, right? That lead to the creation of these groups. I mean, the argument against military action is that, so let's say we do it. Let's say we go in and we defeat ISIS. I have no doubt that the U.S. military could do that, but let's say we do that. And at the end of the day, what have we really achieved? It's a temporary window before something else arises to replace them, the old whack-a-mole argument, right? And so if we don't use all of our soft and hard power, in this case, to address the underlying conditions, the swamp that exists that is creating these entities, we're just going to be right back at this in no time. And that's a much tougher, much more long-term strategy that's required. And that's something that we should be talking a lot more about.
Well, and what is the swamp, Wayne, to use your word? I mean, I remember after 9/11, people talked about, you know, poverty and so forth. But then it turned out that the attackers were, you know, a lot of them were sort of well-educated, middle-class people. So what's the swamp? It isn't just sort of, you know, desperate, poor conditions.
No, in this case, it's a group of people that were completely disaffected by Nouri al-Maliki's government, by promises that were made to them through the surge and
in
the
Iraq.
Uprising
yeah.
in Iraq, sorry, by the United States and others, who felt like they were lied to, who felt like they had no shot at fairness from the Shiite government in Iraq. I mean, those ancient enmities continue to dominate the current conversation. And so, you know, you have tribal leaders matching up with others who basically said, we're not going to just, you know, be victimized. This is their view by what the government of Iraq was doing. Al-Maliki really did a whole lot of damage. But the stage was set earlier when the United States engaged in a process of de-Baathification. You sent a lot of folks home from the army because they were members of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq with no prospects for a future. And so there are lots of, you know, mistakes that were made that contributed to this. Each case is specific, and it's in an individual case, but the longer-term strategy is about much more than just using military force. I would argue that, you know, in the short term, you know, pushing back against ISIS and ISIS successes in the region are important, but just, that doesn't change anything in the long term unless we really address these root causes.
Mm. All right, well, let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We want to hear from you today, your thoughts, reactions, concerns, comments about what happened in Paris, what might happen next, the fear about attacks in this country, 1-800-892-6477. And John is in Manchester. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
First, I'd like to say vive la Paris, and let's care for our allies in Beirut and our friends across the globe who've undergone this sort of attacks for a long time coming. And I'm very thankful that there's thoughtful dialogue going on here, not the war drum that I'm seeing on some other channels being beaten. We have to realize we helped create this situation. They're fighting with American weapons. They're driving brand new Toyota trucks. Those were weapons that just as recently as 4 years ago we dropped off there in supporting rebels, Syrian rebels. We picked wrong allies. So we can't just run back in and pour our own children back into the war, ask this country to do that. We have very wealthy allies. Saudi Arabia, for example, they funded the terrorists in the first attack. And we can cut off those things. They help. So it's time for them to take their military and, as you said, put the skin in the game. You know, some of these tropes of this week are really interesting. I went through September 11th when I was a resident in New York City. And I'm seeing some of the same weird things that are in Congress coming up. Why would a man be blown up? They have to pull the fingertip, a fingerprint from a fingertip indicated that one of the terrorists was a homegrown soldier in Paris, they said. And then the other one had a passport on him. Who brings a passport to an assassination? And how does a passport survive when everything else is blown up?
Yeah, lots of questions, and I really appreciate your call. You know, getting back to, again, James Ramsey, this idea of, you know, people in the region should be handling this. Saudi Arabia, our call is also making the connection with, you know, U.S. involvement in Syria has been kind of, well, difficult to figure out, to say the least. Who do you back? Who do you not back? And so forth.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and we can go back to the idea of complexity. I think the caller makes a couple interesting observations. The U.S. has a gigantic role all around the planet because we need relationships to fuel our economy. That puts us into political alliances, economic alliances around the nation. We have political groups in this country that sort of motivate our political alliances with other nation states. Then we have the Arab League, who was slow to come to the ball in my view during the Arab Spring, realizing what could happen to some of the governments of the UAE and Saudi Arabia. I mean, as the Arab Spring was unfolding, they survived that. And Sarwar's point is well taken. They have skin in the game. This is their fight. We should act in a supportive role. But sort of where are they? And, you know, when you look at sort of the role that the Middle Eastern collective of militaries need to form, they need to form their own collaboration to attack ISIS. And they need to deal with the Assad issue in Syria much more forcefully than just a few words here and there.
Well, I want to ask all of you, sort of switch gears a little bit and talk about the fear that a lot of people have now of homegrown attacks. And over the weekend, we heard about, you know, sites in New York and D.C. and Boston and so forth being hardened, so to speak. All of you, but you first, James, because this is your area, you know, you're a professor of security studies. How robust is our intelligence, are our efforts broadly to prevent these attacks from happening on our soil?
I think our intelligence efforts are incredibly robust. I think our law enforcement is incredibly stressed. And I think the political challenge of heightening our awareness and, quote, tightening security. I mean, I saw that phrase 1,000 times over the weekend going through the news media. Everybody is, quote, tightening security. I would observe that at some point a nation just can't live in that level of preparedness all of the time. So that makes it politically difficult for us to sort of respond to these with heightened sentences of security and tighter security at this, that, and the other checkpoint or this event or that game or what have you. So I think our law enforcement community is well-trained. I think our first responder community is well-trained. I don't think our communities are particularly well-prepared from a resilience perspective.
Yeah, you can't provide security to every, you know, high school football game.
No, I teach my students all the time that we can't afford to protect everything all the time from everything.
So what do you do? Do you protect and what don't you?
Well, you know, that's the difficult call. We use typically governments and municipalities will use risk management-based approaches to prioritize risks in their operating environment and to shore up countermeasures that are affordable and sustainable.
What do you think, Sarwar? Enough robust intelligence here at home?
Well, I do agree with Jim that we really have very robust protections here. I might just take this in a slightly different track to add to what Jim said, and that is that I'm really concerned about some of the messages that are coming out from our presidential candidate. There are people who are saying that we ought to only let in Christians, in the refugees. There are others who are picking once again on the Muslim community in America. And I think if there's one thing that America is known for and that makes it different from Europe and reduces the threat level, if I might say so, is the openness with which American society has handled immigrants of all types. And I would also submit that in these days of stress, when ISIS, which is an extremist Muslim group with no relationship in reality to the religion, is taking the headlines, I think we need to be very careful. Our presidential candidate needs to be very careful in what they say, how they say it, because we certainly don't want to turn a lot of Americans, Muslim Americans, away from focusing on this fight.
Let's take another call. Jonathan joins us from Marlboro, Vermont. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really glad to hear that this discussion has gone away from military solutions and toward humanitarian. That was exactly what I wanted to talk about. It's so important for us to not just welcome refugees, but be kind to our Muslim brothers and sisters who are here now, and to support them in their peace-loving lives. That's what I have to say.
Okay, thank you very much for calling in, Jonathan. So, 2 points. One, Wayne, to you, you know, have you heard, first of all, about a widespread anti-Muslim backlash in this country? And if there is that backlash, how does that sort of change the equation? Go ahead, Wayne.
I think you're seeing a lot of this on social media from folks who are particularly concerned about refugees coming to the United States and, you know, being described as, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing, right? That somehow that among them will be these ISIS fighters who will then, you know, take the war to us here in the United States. I think there's insecurity about that. I think that's perfectly natural to have that fear. And what I would hope the president's going to talk about today is, you know, how we are working to make sure that there are screenings in place and how we are you know, trying to preserve as much security as possible. But to Professor Ramsey's point, you know, at the end of the day, there's only so much that we can do, and there still remains that possibility. So, yeah, sure, we're seeing a lot of this on social media. We're seeing presidential candidates talk about this, as Sarah Archer said, in ways that I would say are oftentimes irresponsible, that appeal to sort of the least common denominator. It's not to underestimate the reality here that there is a very real threat out there. But there are responsible ways in which we can try to address these things, and then there are ways that really are just designed to make people more afraid, and that's sort of what I think we need to push back against.
Well, and again, the president will be talking later this morning, I think around 10:30. NHPR will, of course, be carrying that coverage, so stay with us for that. By the way, because of the attacks, we are not airing our interview with John Kasich last Thursday afternoon, but you can listen to it on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, or on our podcast. James Ramsey, to you too, the refugee question in this country and abroad, how does that change given what's happened?
Well, you know, if we distinguish refugees from immigration, I think that's kind of an important distinction at this point. You know, Europe has been inundated with refugees at a scale that we've not. And they started probably that process with an infrastructure not as robust as ours. So if you look at the forefront countries of Spain and Italy, some of the Mediterranean places in Greece, they have really, they didn't have the economic infrastructure to start with to maintain their activities of daily living in their normal economy. And then you add this refugee crisis, which is extremely stressful and challenging. And then you add the potential element of fear that who maybe is living among them, so to speak, and desperate times. I mean, I've never been a refugee, you know, but I can imagine, and I've known some, that this is an extremely stressful time of life. So refugees are one thing, and I think we need to deal with that quite separately. And Europe certainly has to deal with its Schengen policy. But from an immigration perspective, we should talk about that a little bit, because there have been some activities domestically over the weekend that are going to make immigration look more difficult here.
All right. We'll pick up on that in just a moment. And you can keep calling in 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, reactions in the U.S. and here in New Hampshire to the Paris attacks over the weekend. Give us a call with your thoughts, feelings, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. My guests are Sarwar Kashmiri, a fellow of the Foreign Policy Association, adjunct professor at Norwich University. He speaks often before business and military audiences. His last book was NATO 2.0. Also with us, Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College, contributor to the forthcoming book, The New Islamic State. And with me in studio, James Ramsey, professor of security studies at UNH. And James, just before the break, you were saying there are lots of domestic implications to these attacks that we haven't even really sorted out yet. I want to let you finish up that point.
Okay. Thank you, Laura. One can imagine back in World War II, when we had concerns about ethnic groups around the world that we became suspicious of after, you know, the Japanese internments through FDR's executive order comes to mind as a great example. Some of the fallout that might happen here with our immigration policy, which we've already started to witness, is, lack of confidence in immigration sanctuaries, as we've seen in the press, 340 some cities across the country listed as immigration sanctuaries. And of course, for the listener, and I'm not an expert on a sanctuary, but as I understand them, the sanctuaries are there to enhance law enforcement's ability to communicate and to produce community-based policing efforts, which diffuse fear and trepidation among immigrants and to foster a working relationship.
I see. That's the hearts and minds stuff that we've been talking about all hour. Okay.
Right. And so a hardening of the heart around that from the U.S. side on the pretense that there is a fear of who is among us, some of which is very well founded with the murder in California of an armed Mexican illegal, for instance, just recently. As a good example. So, you're looking at immigration in the United States, policies around immigration, which is always a hot political topic anyway, and you combine this with this, the Paris incident, the Beirut incident, the Russia incident, the forced projection of ISIS, and on top of that, you combine that with an election year where the politics of fear sell really, really effectively, and we are sitting on a precipice here in the U.S., I think, of potentially developing domestic policy that may be really, really difficult.
All right, let's go back to our listeners. David's in Keene. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. When there was a message from ISIS after it happened that they did it, and it was because of, I think they said it was because of policies that France had, and they wanted those policies to stop. I'm wondering what those policies were that they didn't like.
Yeah, David, thank you. And Sarwar, he's right. ISIS said to teach France and all nations following its path that they will remain top targets. Sarwar, can you jump in on David's question there?
Sure, David. I think the big issue that the ISIS folks wanted to point out is that France ought not to be there bombing them. France ought not to be in this fight. And why is France becoming so aggressive towards the Middle East? And I think buried in that, David, if I may say, is that France and Syria, go back a long way. If you go and read some of the history, you'll find that when France ran Syria as a colony, when Syrians tried to become independent, France used terrible firepower to kill men, women, children. These people have long memories. So it's a combination of things, but basically I think ISIS is simply warning France, stay away, you fight us, we'll fight you.
Well, and Wayne, to you, so implications for the U.S., if we sort of jump in with both feet and, start doing more, whether it's boots on the ground or whatever, in Syria, does ISIS send the same message to us? Or have we already crossed that threshold?
I think we're well across that line. I don't think ISIS needs any more motivation to try to go after Americans. And I think that's certainly part of their goal. So I think Sarwar is exactly right. This was a message to sort of get France to back off, to the extent that they can sort of split the coalition of nations that are going after ISIS. I think that was part of it as well. But as far as the U.S. is concerned, if there is an opportunity, they surely will take it.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much, David, for the call. And John in Westminster, Vermont. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Yeah, I was saying before, it's good that we try to help these refugees out, but, we do have to be aware of ISIS getting involved in things, and we certainly, in my opinion, have enough of our own issues that we should be working on. And it's just the Middle East is always going to be a hot spot, in my opinion, because they've been fighting for since mankind existed, in my opinion. And I don't think we're ever going to really be getting in, you know, solve their problems. It's only because of their oil that we're really over there to begin with, as far as I'm concerned, anyway, that is.
Well, John, thank you for calling. And, you know, you addressed this earlier, James Ramsey, but I'll ask you again. Once again, John, raising a concern that we've heard from others, the refugees, and fears that there may be some infiltrators among them. You talked earlier about children being inculcated. So, you know.
Yeah, and the percentage of female recruits is never – is that sort of an all-time high when it
right.
comes
people
to –
Right. People say it's women and children. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I'm referring specifically to the percentage of female recruits that our intel services give us going over to fight in the region. You know, it's cliche probably and irrelevant to say that we're a nation of immigrants. I mean, but we sort of – we are, and we've always had this – difficult relationship with immigration, but you know there's no perfect solution. I mean, we will allow in X percent of our people be perfectly wonderful immigrants. They become model Americans. They add to the economy. They add to our infrastructure, our cultural diversity, add to our strength. And then there are those that become bad apples. And how many lawfully admitted Americans joined biker gangs or violent criminal organizations or the organized mob? You know, so, I mean, just because you're of one religious or ethnic background or another doesn't preclude you to one fate or another. And if we have immigration coming on in or obviously, if we stop immigration because of a fear of 0.01% of the bad apples getting in, I think that has implications as to who we are as a nation.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, Sara Kashmiri, as I said earlier, your latest book was NATO 2.0. What sorts of conversations do you think are happening at NATO right now? Isn't the NATO saying, you know, an attack against one is an attack against all or something like that?
I suspect at this point NATO, all the countries that belong to it, are deep in conversation. I should remind your listeners that NATO is run by a board of directors called the North Atlantic Council, on which sit all of the countries that are part of the NATO alliance. So when one country is attacked, the so-called Article 5 says, you know, if you attack one country, you attack us all. Well, it doesn't automatically trigger the article. All these countries have to get together and unanimously vote to invoke Article 5. Then after they do that, there is no NATO army, so each country contributes planes and soldiers and so on. It's a hugely bureaucratic process which sometimes works, sometimes doesn't work. And as you know, most of the 28 countries that belong to NATO have very, very small budgets. As an example, the Netherlands, the increase in their social security budget last year was greater than the entire defense budget. And so I'm not certain that France or America are really going to want NATO involved because of that bureaucracy and lack of capability. But at this point, I suspect they're all talking, but their eyes, I think, are more towards Russia. That's where most of the NATO training and coordination is going on. So I don't see NATO getting involved in this. I don't see France and America invoking NATO's Article 5 and their involvement.
I want to share an email from Gary in Sugar Hill, who says, after we defeated Japan, Italy, Austria, and Germany, we rebuilt these countries. Gary says the U.S. had no interest in investing our resources in Iraq and Afghanistan, so we made enemies by making no attempt to make friends. Gary says, so even people who may have been sympathetic have turned against us. Today, our feelings seem irreconcilable. What do you think, Wayne Lesperance? And Gary, thanks for the email.
I think I'd say that's a little bit of apples and oranges. The United States invested a lot of money, a tremendous amount of money, in Iraq and Afghanistan. In terms of rebuilding the way we did Japan and Germany, not the same. But we also did not maintain a military presence in Iraq for 50 years, right, and the way we have and longer in Germany and Japan. So they're not exactly the same, but I think the broader point of, you know, standing those countries up, creating institutions, creating infrastructure, insisting that the governments in Iraq in particular does not engage in policies that are hostile to segments of the population that are, you know, different particular faith, is something that we could have tried to do more of. I don't want to absolve the United States of responsibility here. We bear a lot of the responsibility for what's going on in current day Iraq, but so do others, and so does the Iraqi government. So a bit of apples and oranges in terms of those comparisons, in my view.
Well, Gary, thank you for the email. And gentlemen, we have to close out a little early. I've just gotten word that the president has decided to start his news conference on this topic a little bit early. So I apologize. Have to let you go 4 or 5 minutes out before the hour. And James Ramsey, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
James Ramsey, professor of security studies at UNH. Wayne Lesperance, always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Wayne Lesperance, he's at New England College. His forthcoming book is The New Islamic State, Sawar Kashmiri. Thank you again for your time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sawar Kashmiri, fellow at the Foreign Policy Association. This is The Exchange on NHPR.